The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
It's been a long time since I've read any psychological studies on demon possession, authored by American people, North Americans. But I guess my own feeling is that so many psychiatrists tend to read the instances of demon possession in the Scripture, in the New Testament particularly, and then just sort of psychoanalyze them as, here's a bad case of schizophrenia, and here's a mythological way of expressing the fact that man needs wholeness in God, something of the sort. And that, to my mind, really displaces radically both what the Bible says, and also I think it does injustice to the phenomenological facts of what takes place in those things as we see them on the field. Mm. Really not fair to anything. But boy, the work needs to get done. I've already said something about ancestors, but again, this deep sense of cosmic harmony, okay? When sacrifice is offered when the cosmic harmony is broken, when the norm is not kept. So basically, evil then, within animism, is not rebellion against the spirits, it's disharmony. You know, be careful of that. If you're preaching and you're going to use this whole concept of cosmic disharmony, be very careful that you don't sort of back into trouble by assuming that the animist's sense of brokenness is the biblical sense of brokenness. The animist is not talking about brokenness or sin in terms of rebellion against a personal living God. He thinks of this brokenness in terms of, or this evil, as it were, just in terms of something you have done that has shattered the harmony, a taboo perhaps you've broken, and only that. So here you've got to be careful again. Norm?
But the sacrifices are not only to restore harmony, they're to maintain the ongoing harmony.
Yeah. Right,
like
right.
You said before about the rites when they begin planting. And that's
sort of insurance guarantees.
Yeah. It's just part of the natural way that it's probably the same category as planting the seed. If you want to have a crop, you've got to plant the seed. And before you plant the seed, you've got to... It's all part of the harmony, right? You know, that... two-sided aspect to the sacrifice.
Yeah, and even there, that's helpful. I think generally when, as evangelicals, when you see that for the first time, I remember the first time I was present in a village when they offered sacrifices. And it was a small village, and once a year the village offered sacrifices to the spirit on the hill. The village was at the bottom of the hill. There was a river and always a danger of flooding. And so once a year, there was a high hill, and once a year, the village as in mass offered sacrifices to the spirit of the hill. They had a very small shrine at the top of the hill, just almost a little box. Then once a year, one villager was selected who then isolated himself for a certain period of time. Then when the time came, the entire village gathered at the shrine, and food had been prepared for the spirit, and the food was brought to the spirit, and then the entire village, after a certain time of veneration, after the spirit could come to eat the food, then the entire village ate the food with the spirit. Now, when I first saw that, that really got me. Whether wisely or unwisely, I interrupted the service with a lengthy sermon. Fortunately, I didn't get killed, but yes, in Korean. Now I wonder if part of if there wasn't something I did wrong there. I saw the worship only as that which was offered to an idol, only as the creation's substitute for the Creator God, and I still think that's perfectly true and biblical. But what I didn't have sensitivity for was all that was involved in the doing of it, you know, that Norm's pointing out and that we're trying to point out, so that I could have dealt with it, I think, much more adequately by giving a biblical response at that point to those things for which those sacrifices were made as a felt need. Do you get what I'm saying? In other words, I could at that point have spoken about the harmony of the creation, and I could have spoken about the fact that man by his sin has disrupted the harmony. But now no sacrifice is needed anymore, because God himself has sent his Son as a sacrifice to restore the harmony and to bring us into peace with God. I would, as to my mind, in that setting, I would have been dealing with the very same question or issue, only the message would have been much more sensitive to why that process was taking place. That, I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Would you...
No, I think I wouldn't know. I think what I would do, however, would be to wait. And I think I would say, if I were going into that village again, I would time the entrance.
How then, I see in your preaching there Jesus and the cross and the resurrection, but you haven't dealt at that point with what we would call guilt before God. You're talking instead about restoring harmony. Is that adequate?
Boy,
I feel like that. That's a good starting place. We start at the felt needs, and then eventually, through teaching, gradually some of these other things. But if that's the felt need in that particular situation, I feel that that's a legitimate starting place. It doesn't mean you end.
And could it be also, Hank, Norm, that in that particular setting, the sin or evil, I don't think they call it sin, though this is another linguistic difficulty. In many languages, you can't make distinctions between sin and evil the way you can in English. But... at any rate, in many cultures, particularly third world and face-to-face cultures, as Nida points out, the orientation of evil or sin is never on guilt, it's on shame. And that whereas in a Western culture, you know, the focus of our understanding of our responsibility with regards to guilt and sin is usually sin and evil is usually on our guilt. The question I would have then would be, is that fully or really accurately biblical? And I guess I tend, and I may be wrong here, but I tend, as I read the scripture, to see both elements present. In the Genesis story, for example, there is the element of guilt. You know, Adam is responsible. And yet, at the same time, there's also the theme of shame. In the realization of what Adam and Eve have done, and they were naked before God, and they were ashamed, and they hid themselves. Now, I don't see that element of shame being preached or picked up much by Westerners. And I wonder if maybe the reason isn't because culturally that doesn't fit us. We'd much rather talk about guilt. Whereas a third world culture orients itself much more to shame.
Mistaken shame, not sin either.
So why not why not then, is either then thing adequate, and why can't we hit both? But maybe at least to start with, from what Hank is saying, touch base with where that culture is at. If it's a question, if it's a shame-oriented culture, all right, begin from there. But we want to do more than just outline that. And as well, in the West. The Western just does not seem to have that sense of shame. And it gets worse, I think. but anyway, the ancestors in all of this are the function very often as the communicators of the norm. And they communicate through oral traditions in the culture. So the ancestors, according to animistic systems, discovered and formulated the norms, and the ancestors guard them. So every offense against morals is an offense against the ancestors. And for that reason, you must keep in continual contact with the ancestors. The ancestor, then, is not simply a human forebear whose way of life resembled that of the tribe or the clan. We noted the name, just mentioned ago, the name of John Mbidi. He is, I guess, probably the big name scholar, student of African religions. And his work is one, for those of you who are going to Africa, you really ought to work with or know about. Anyway, Mbidi has a lot to say about ancestor concepts. And he notes that in African religions, the ancestors are the tribal links with the original time, when all things were ordered and when the rules for society were made. Here's the Eliade theme again. So the ancestors are our guardians, the guardians of our link with the great totality of the cosmos. They are our link with norm. So if you're in a Confucian culture, to refuse to venerate your ancestors is to stand against the cosmic order. To refuse to venerate your ancestors is to stand against the cosmic norm. And I think this is why, for example, in Korea, Japan, China, ancestor worship becomes the major obstacle to the presentation of the gospel. And it's not just simply because it has to do with worship, it has to do with ancestors. And with the fact that the ancestors within Confucianism, within that grand total system, are those who guard the past, and they guard the norms. So that if you're the firstborn son in a Confucian family, that automatically raises a tremendous barrier to your becoming a Christian, because it is your task to venerate the ancestors. And by venerating the ancestors, it is your responsibility to guard the cosmos. And it is your responsibility to preserve the norms, to preserve the law. So by breaking with the ancestors, you are breaking with the law. And that's why it is such a tremendous break in Asia when the firstborn son becomes a Christian, because he's got to renounce all of that. And it is, it's also the reason why it is so difficult for elderly people to become Christians, because they know that it means turning their back on, you know, all the ordered creation, as it were. In the latest issue of the Evangelical Missions Quarterly, there's an excellent article on ancestor worship. Have you seen that, Mr. Cho, Mr. Chung? It's very, very good. The Evangelical Missions Quarterly, it's the January 1983 issue. It is on ancestor worship in Taiwan, and it is written by a graduate of Westminster Seminary who's a pastor in Taiwan, Daniel Hung. And it's very, very good. But what makes it fascinating is that Daniel Hung's mother was an animist all of her life, a Confucianist. And in her 80s, on her deathbed, became a believer. And Daniel has written up this whole thing as sort of a case study in how the Chinese see their family and their ancestry in connection with this great cosmic whole and the norm. And I think all of those things are needed to sort of nuance out all this way of looking at this. Or, you know, ancestors then don't really have any place. They're just sort of odd little folks who don't fit. But Mbidi and many from Asia are beginning to see how they're tied in with this larger picture.
Does it have any point of contact with them, whether Confucius or somebody in ancestor worship? The fact that we worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob?
I think it does, Tom. I guess I feel there are, in an area like that, there is a lot of mining of biblical data we have not even begun to touch. And what would it mean, you know, to in a culture or in a system that has such a rich place for ancestors, for us to really start digging out and helping people understand what is this about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob?
Also, the use of genealogy in the Bible.
Yeah.
The same thing. The Hebrews really had the same sort of respect, at least, for their heritage.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe we as Western people aren't keeping up with biblical tradition in that sense.
Yeah, right. But even there, you know, I guess,
I think it reflects our individualism in Western culture that we don't see that. We don't have the same appreciation of our families.
I think somewhere in Kraft's book, he talks about, maybe not, all these things start flowing together, but he comments on a series of Bible studies that a missionary was running, and they were going through, was it the Gospel of Luke, or the Gospel of Matthew, and maybe it was Kraft, and he was very anxious to get through chapter 1 as soon as he could, so he could get into the good stuff. And after he had spent a brief time, he noticed that there was an awful lot of discussion about Matthew chapter 1. Everybody was asking all kinds of questions about the first 18 verses. And he was anxious to keep moving. Finally, he got to what he conceived of as the interesting thing. And he said interest seemed to disappear, or wane at least. And then very shortly afterwards, several of the Africans asked him, when are we going to get back to the interesting things? Now, I think all of that just underlines what Hank is saying. Why haven't we made rich use of the genealogical materials of both the Old Testament and the New Testament in a setting where ancestors are so prominent to talk about Jesus? I have in Korea, for example, where ancestors are a key factor in terms of obstacles to the gospel, I have never... And in the 12 years I was there, I have never heard a sermon on any of the genealogies of the Old Testament. And yet, I feel that's a powerful weapon to use.
And Ms. Brick, excuse me.
So good.
Norm and I were talking about something that relates to this. I found that most of the nationals, and I'm sure indirectly as a fellow missionary, but most of the nationals don't have very much appreciation for any of this. And you begin to talk about any of these problems... that relate to their animistic religion, our ancestors, and the expression they use, Makamana Bakoko. That's the thing of our ancestors. And usually they immediately talk about, you know, that's all of evil, that's all the past, that's all Satan. And there's no appreciation for it at all. It's just almost an overreaction against all this. And that really bothers me.
One of the... Niebuhr, in his book Christ and Culture, talks about the various attitudes towards culture that have developed in the history of Christianity. And that book, I think, by the way, has a very... The typology of it is very, very helpful. Forget Niebuhr's own answers. And forget also the fact that he doesn't really deal with anything other than just Western theology. But he says you've got, as I remember, about five different attitudes towards culture within the Christian church. On the one end of the extreme is the Christ of culture attitude. He says this is typified in, for example, Gnosticism, in which Christianity sort of merges into the culture. the attitude of Justin, Clement of Alexandria, you know, Jesus as the Logos doctrine. Then the opposite end is Christ against culture. And I wonder, I think it's Kraft uses the same model and asks if this Christ against culture model is not very dominant in much of our work overseas. It's the exact opposite of the other, in which you sort of totally turn your back on the culture and find nothing in it of any value whatsoever. And the example of this in the early church would be Tertullian. What has Jerusalem to do with Athens? Where you have a total turning your back on the existent culture, seeing it only as corrupt and of no worth at all. And I sense a lot of that in our evangelical community. Then in between you have the various mediating attitudes. Fortunately, Niebuhr comes down on what we would consider to be the right side. What looks like a fairly good model to most of us is Christ as the transformer of culture. And here he puts Calvin and John Wesley. So that satisfies all kinds of evangelicals. But I think he's got a point, though. When Niebuhr's through, of course, he says, well, not even this model is really right. But he makes very clearly a difference here between Christ against culture and Christ as the transformer of culture. And I think this is where Bovink fits when he talks about possessio, about possessing a culture for Christ. You're not rejecting the culture, and you're not affirming it. You are watching as Christ transforms it. That, I think, is pretty helpful. But I suspect our churches need to be reminded of that, because we do tend... maybe part of it's natural, you know, Hank. New converts. Remember when some of you were just new Christians and all those sermons you heard about rejecting the world? Remember you turn your back on your former non-Christian friends because I've got to live for Jesus. And the tendency sometimes can be to sort of just totally give it up. And then later on, you begin to see, maybe I've done a few things haywire here, and you start to try to build bridges back, and it may be too late. But that kind of balance sometimes is missing in a church's first encounter with Jesus Christ and the cultures they're a part of.
I think it's easier to...
Go ahead, Mr. John.
How do you think Christian family have... family worship service for
or ancestors.
Memorial.
Huh? Memorial service.
Yeah.
I was afraid you'd ask that, Mr. John. All right, I would have no problems with that kind of service under certain conditions. I would think of it as what Bovink refers to in his essay as possessing that practice for Christ. And in fact, in his book, Introduction to the Science of Missions, Bovink gives that as an example. That you can possess even the practice of ancestor veneration for Christ. How? Well, in many cases in the original rites of ancestor veneration, there are certain symbolic actions that are taken. Incense is burned. Maybe in front of the family, a picture is put up, draped in black. Then in front of the picture, all of the members of the family will bow to the picture. Then incense is also burned. There is also very frequently in some cultures a clapping of hands. This is tied in with the... a calling of the Spirit to come and participate now with the family. And then there's also frequently a sacrificial meal which is placed on a tablet in front of the picture. Then there's a bow, and there's a significant period of waiting, which you're waiting for the Spirit come to eat the meal. Now, I think some of those things must go. For example, personally, I do not think it would be wise to burn incense sticks. I do not think it's wise to clap hands. I don't think it would be wise to bow before the picture of the dead, because of all the religious meaning that these things have. There are religious symbols associated with the Buddhist, with Buddhist ideas and Confucian ideas towards the dead, animist concepts. At the same time, I would see nothing wrong with, let's say, on the anniversary in Korea, for example, or Japan, on the anniversary of the one who's died, of bringing out the picture and putting the picture on a table. I see nothing wrong with that. Or, let's say, even putting black ribbon around the picture. I don't see anything wrong with that. I think it would be a good time then to have a special time of worship, call in the pastor, and there, with the picture, there present, and maybe non-Christian members of the family, you would hold a memorial service. The pastor would preach a Christian gospel message about death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. He might even say some things about the one who's died. There would even be the eating of a meal together. But the meal would be prefaced by prayer, not by bowing before the picture. I think that would be a proper, adequate substitute for that practice. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree.
Now, in, for example, in Taiwan recently, Daniel Hung and I were talking about some of these things. In a Chinese family, in every family there is a tablet. There is a small box which is kept closed. Inside the box is a tablet, something resembling a tablet, on which are inscribed the ancestral names. At a certain period of time, the tablet is, the book box is opened. The whole family is present when it's opened. There is the burning of incense sticks, and then the names are read, and then there is a bow to the tablet. Many Christians, as I remember, Mr. Hung told me, in Chinese homes, the Christians are forbidden to use that tablet, and as a mark of the Christian faith, must destroy the tablets and cannot engage in that practice. Number one, there is wisdom in that. Number two, I think it's foolish too. I think it is too radical a break. So, what would I do? All right, I would have a box in my home if I were a Christian in Taiwan. I would have a box with doors, but the doors would always be open. I do not open or close, because this idea of the symbolism, as I understand it, of the opening and closing is that when you open the box, you let the spirits out. And I want to keep the box open to let people know there are no spirits inside this box. There, I might keep a record, a tablet, of the names of my ancestors. And I would know enough about them to show respect, and when others came into my home, to be able to talk about the names on the tablets. But I would not bow to the tablets. I would not burn incense before the tablets. But they could be there as a sign of respect. Mr. Hung, I think, suggested that it might be good, in front of the box, to put an open Bible. Open the Bible at Exodus 20, and to underline the words, "Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God giveth you." So that you're drawing attention by that to the fact that this is part of your calling as a Christian, to respect your father and mother. But it's a Christian activity, not Buddhist or Confucian. And you're not praying to your ancestors, but you are respecting them. I think that might be another way to make a useful substitute.
Did you say that they pray for their ancestors?
No. I don't think it's possible for Christians to do that. It's very similar to my mind to praying for the dead. And In fact, I wondered about the history of the Roman Catholic custom of praying for the dead, whether it didn't originate in some form of animism that entered the church in the 4th and 5th centuries when the Gothics, the Goths invaded, the barbarians invaded the empire. So I don't see how a Christian can do that. I think that a Christian could pray in a service like that, in a ceremony, and a Christian could thank God for his ancestors. I think a Christian in prayer could thank God for the piety and the kindness of his father and his mother, even if they were non-Christians. I think a Christian could, in front of other non-Christians, could pray and thank God for the wisdom and the love that his father and mother had given to him. I think this also would say something to the non-Christian. But under no circumstances would you pray to them themselves, or pray as if they were still living. Mr. Chung.
Most Korean Christian families do, as you said. But difference between Christian families and Confucianism families. Confucianism families have ancestor worship for four generation ancestors.
Four generations.
Yeah, but Christian families only parents.
Is that so? That's interesting. Well, I think I would be willing to go all the way to four. Maybe even five or six. I think, I'm not sure that, I don't know the whether there would be any religious significance to the four as over against the two. But certainly I think I could be grateful to God for my grandparents and for my great-grandparents and for my great-great-grandparents. And if that would also say to the non-Christian, we are not trying to forget our parents or our ancestors, then I think it should be done. So it's a question of balance. How, on the one hand, to show proper respect, but on the other hand, to show also very clearly we are not worshiping. This is different.
But the problem is this function, liquidity is all right, but in popular religion, you know, in their mind,
it's
they
not seen that way.
One from the other.
Right, right. I guess the only way I can think of clarifying that, Paulus, is that it seems to me, since the family would gather on the occasion of a death, of the anniversary of a death, that all of this should be accompanied by teaching. This is a marvelous opportunity to share the gospel. I would accompany all of this by teaching and instruction, explaining what we were doing, so that when people saw what we were doing, at least we had tried to tell them. Now, they may still misunderstand. I've seen that in Korea, too. But I think it is more dangerous to simply discard everything than it is to try some of these things with explanation. I think many people, McGavern, Tippett, often talk about a power encounter and comment that syncretism arises more quickly in the church when you do not look for sort of Christian substitutes to these practices. And that reminds me of the biblical story, you know, of the Lord who sweeps a room clean of a devil, and then the room is empty, and because it's empty, seven devils occupy it. And I think you get more trouble when you leave empty rooms.
What about using, our quote, spiritual ancestors in terms of biblical figures?
Yeah. You know, Daniel Hung suggested that in China, perhaps, the same connection. On our ancestral tablets, he said, why not put the names of, start with Adam, put the names of Adam, Moses,
Abraham.
Noah, Abraham, Jesus.
The Jews made up big.
And I think that there's a lot of wisdom there. I like that idea. So that once more, you know, Hudson Taylor, Che Guevara, you know, Paul McCoy. Oh, boy, we are getting ridiculous. Hank.
One thing I was just going to say is where you're going into an area where the church is established, I think we as missionaries have to be very careful to respect the judgment of the national pastors and others.
Yeah.
I have questions like the one was just asked in class, and sometimes I'll give some opinions, but I'll often throw it back to them and try to draw them out, because sometimes,
Yeah, right. I agree.
It's so easy, you know, that we don't see what that might do to some Christian.
Yeah.
I think this is what Paul is getting at. We really wouldn't understand this thing. So I try to just provide a sort of a permissive spirit in class, at least to talk about some of these things. And I'm feeling that maybe in our area, a lot of our younger pastors are getting more sensitive to this. But our older ones, who came maybe more directly out of paganism, they're just, you know, all this is terrible. And I think in a quick question of period of time, gradually some of these things will...
Yeah, I think that's very good advice. I appreciate that.
My grandfather came from an Eastern Orthodox church in India. And the mouth of my church was filled with problem, because in the Eastern Orthodox church, just like the Catholics, they still have the anniversaries and memorial services and praying for their souls and things of that kind. And our church decided not to have any memorial service at all, because we are thankful for our grandfather every day, not just for that particular one day in which he died. There is absolutely no significance. So I'm not suggesting that this should be the model, but the danger in having all these memorial services every year is that we can get into Christian paganism very easily.
It's all right. I think this is a good place to end for today. Well, we were talking when we finished yesterday or quit about the ancestor, the place of ancestors in the process, and okay, one other thing, in terms of this, I think what I see also in animism very frequently in this effort to sort of preserve the original harmony, it also shows up in rituals related to time, timing, chronology. So Bobbing says that in many animistic groups, the yearly calendar becomes kind of a ritualized symbol of the great cosmic year. Mani afishin moin demo. I'm kidding Mr. Chung, because he didn't come to hear me last night. For example, a good sample of this, sort of a leftover in American culture, would be astrology and what's your sign. The Babylon, and that flows, of course, from the Babylonian religion originally. That is the idea that the circulation of the stars and the relationship of the planets control your destiny. They norm out your life. It's a basic form of animism, and we're still following it today. So it's awfully important for a lot of people in the United States what sign you are. Hello, I'm Leo. You know,
oh, I figured that.
It's been a long day. So each calendar then preserves, particularly with regards to festivals, kind of a hierophany, that term that comes from Eliade, a hierophany of the chaos out of which the world was made. The calendar then becomes a kind of a religious reflector on time. The calendar, the way you look at the whole year as it flows by you, becomes all of it becomes sort of a religious process. In some animistic cultures, then, for example, the calendar, there is this reflection of the idea that once there was chaos, once there was the abolition of all norms, the absence of all values, and then values came and order came out of the chaos in the original cycle. Now this is often then re-celebrated each year, preferably at the time of the harvest. So that when you harvest, what you're doing is celebrating order out of the chaos. Sometimes also at the springtime, when you first begin to break the earth, you're going back to the beginning once more. Sometimes you might want to look and see if in the particular tribal group you're working with, whether some of these symbols are present in the time of how does the animist in your particular culture observe springtime? What kinds of religious rites does he carry on? How are they connected together? Here is the Eliade says in his book. It talks about this in his book, The Myth of the Eternal Return, and he says that it's especially important. What harvest does is to confirm the symmetry. This is his language, the symmetry between the dissolution of the form in the soil, that's the seed being planted, and that of social forms, the social forms in the chaos. So you're planting the seeds of order in the chaos, as it were. And in doing that, you're going back once more. Your memory is a hierophany of the beginning, way back at the start. The medieval commemoration of All Hallows Eve, what we now call Halloween, is this kind of ritual. Probably a remnant of animism. Baptized into the church, and so it fits in. Another very similar practice to this that comes from the Bible would be the religion of the Canaanites. You remember when Elijah, there's a lot of anthropological significance to Elijah's battle with the Canaanite priests, so, and particularly over the instrument that the Lord uses in his sort of eclectic apologetic with the Canaanite religion, so he doesn't let the rain come, because at the heart of the Canaanite religion was the idea of fertility. It was the Canaanite gods who made the earth fertile. It was the Canaanite gods who brought the seasons. So that when the Lord stops the rain from falling, he is directly encountering animism of this particular sort. And if you remember, you know, one of the things that made the Canaanite religion so awful was not just its animistic practices with regards to the earth, but also with regards to human fertility and sexuality. So they were connected with the Canaanite religious system, temple prostitutes. And the idea being that not only... That through the worship of the Canaanite Baal gods, not only was the earth made fertile, but also human fertility was encouraged and cultivated. And water, as Eliade points out, was also used in many of the rites as a sexual symbol, as a symbol of the male semen. And so that there's a lot of implications going on there in the history of that encounter of Elijah with the Canaanite gods. That's a very interesting sample in your Old Testament of animism, in a very powerful sort. So the springtime became really crucial, because the wintertime, there was chaos. You know, you had reverted to the original beginning. And then in spring, the order comes. In the spring, the rain comes to water the earth, and everything becomes fertile, the fruits of the blessing of the Baal gods. And that's the time when the Lord pronounces his curse on this religion and stops the heavens from giving their rain. And that's a good passage to preach if you're working in animistic tribes. I've used that one very frequently in Korean areas in the rural countryside. It presents a very powerful passage to use in terms of talking about who God is and what God can do, particularly when you understand the relations between the Canaanite religion and animism. In this whole system, magic functions as the preserver of the unity, of cosmic unity. And magic functions also as the judge of those who disturb the harmony. Now, Eugene Nida, when he talks about magic in many of his books, he sees magic as sort of an attempt to kind of communicate with supernatural powers. I think the problem with that way of approaching magic is that it serves only to underline its positive kind of side. Because magic has a positive side and it has a negative side. Magic has a malevolent purpose as well. It's not just simply used by people as an attempt to communicate in a positive way with the spirit world. It's also an attempt to communicate in a negative way and to bring the judgments of the spirit world, or reinforce them, as it were. Magic, from that point of view, too, also serves as kind of the animistic alternative to a covenant relationship with God. And I think this is helpful. Putting it biblically, magic becomes a technique of the autonomous man within traditional societies for manipulating the gods. You know, it's like Romans 1 again. Here's through magic, you reach out to try and control God. So, in other words, I guess here too, I think Nida's kind of Nida's explanation is not deep enough. Magic is not just simply a means of one more alternative means of communication, but it flows out of the heart, the rebellious heart, as an alternative to piety, to devotion to God. It's one more effort to try and control. And the place where this is brought out, I think, beautifully, it's sort of the paganistic reversal of God's revelation. And you, instead of yourself letting yourself be used by God for the Lord's purposes, for His covenant purposes, you sort of drag God down to the level of a tool, which then you can use for your own purposes. So it is magic then becomes an instrument of compulsion. And I guess I would say it's an instrument of compulsion in which a human being tries to resolve the tension between I and the norm. All right, here's this conflict, I and the norm. And there's tension here. Somehow or other, the animus senses something's broken up here. There's disharmony. How can you restore the harmony? How can you control the harmony? And magic becomes the effort to psychologically to try and control the balance there. And you do it by controlling the norm, the source of the norm.